Registration is now open for the 2018 Apologetics Canada Conference. The conference is located in beautiful Abbotsford, British Columbia on March 2nd and 3rd. We have another amazing lineup of speakers. Get all the details and register at apologeticscanadaconference.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Steve Kim.
Andy Steiger.
Terry Crosby.
All three of us are here, finally. This is becoming something of a novelty now.
Yeah, it's been a while, but it's good to be back with the team. Looking forward to our topic today.
If you're a thoughtful Christian, at some point in your walk, you come to wrestle with the questions about human origin. How do I interpret the opening chapters of Genesis? Is it a metaphor? Is it literal history? Or how do I reconcile this with science? So on and so forth. There are a number of theories that are proposed, one major theory being theistic evolution, the idea that God used evolution or guided evolution to bring about humanity. So we've managed to get a hold of Dr. Stephen Meyer to speak into this today. He's the director of the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute. He's the author of Signature in the Cell, DNA and the Evidence for Intelligent Design, as well as Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. Most recently, though, he co-edited a massive volume called Theistic Evolution, a Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Critique. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Meyer.
It's great to be with you guys.
I was at the Evangelical Philosophical Society, and this year there in Rhode Island, you had a panel that discussed this book. Now, that was the first time I was introduced to this. That was a fantastic panel. And one of the things that you started with, Dr. Meyer, is you talked about how you were invited to the Royal Society. Could you just talk to our listeners a little bit about that? And maybe even before that, just kind of talk about how this book came about and the reason that you wrote it.
Well, sure. I wasn't invited to the Royal Society, but attended the Royal Society conference on the current status of evolutionary theory in November of 2016. And it turned out at the society there were about 200 scientists, and well over 10% of them were supportive of the theory of intelligent design. We actually had a little side meeting afterwards. And the meeting itself was interesting because the mainstream evolutionary biologists were quite candid about the difficulties facing contemporary evolutionary theory. In fact, the first talk at the conference was by Gerd Müller, a leading Austrian evolutionary biologist, who started the conference by enumerating what he called explanatory deficits of neo-Darwinism, the mainstream textbook theory of evolution that we all learn in high school and college biology classes. And he, among other problems, he noted that neo-Darwinism lacks a theory of the generative. It doesn't explain the origin of morphological innovation. It does a good job of explaining small-scale variation, but not large-scale innovation. Can explain, for example, the variation in the length and shape of Galapagos finch beaks, but it doesn't tell us where birds came from in the first place. And he also talked about the problem of the origin of phenotypic complexity, the complexity that's in the visible body types and body plans of organisms, and the problem of the abrupt appearance of major groups of organisms in the fossil record in events such as the Cambrian explosion, which, as you mentioned, I had written about previously. So the problems with the Darwinian mechanism, the neo-Darwinian mechanism of mutation, natural selection, are increasingly well noted in mainstream evolutionary biology itself. And the rest of the conference was discussing alternative mechanisms that could be proposed to remedy the deficiencies of the mutation selection mechanism. But
which is a big deal for those who don't know about the Royal Society. I mean, we're talking about the highest echelon of science.
Yeah, it's the oldest and arguably most august scientific body in the world, and that they would schedule a conference to discuss the status of current evolutionary thinking with a special emphasis on the problems of neo-Darwinism and the need for a new mechanism to supplement the lack of creative power in the standard evolutionary mechanism. It's pretty significant. Then back to your question about the our book on theistic evolution. In my opening essay, I juxtaposed what's going on in mainstream evolutionary biology, in the secular field of evolutionary biology, with what's going on in much of the in the religious and Christian world, where many evangelical, Catholic, Jewish, other theistic scientists, biologists are saying, gosh, we need to baptize, in effect, the neo-Darwinian mechanism, claim and say that this is was God's way of creating at just the time when people in the mainstream field of evolutionary biology are saying this mechanism has no creative power. So it's very odd to equate the creative power with God, of God, with a mechanism that clearly lacks creative power. That seems to be an odd sort of strategy, and yet it's a very well-funded strategy, especially in the United States and Britain, with different theistic evolutionist organizations such as BioLogos in the United States or Faraday Institute in the UK. And so there's been a lot of pressure on theologians, biblical scholars, and Christian leaders to accept the modern Darwinian account of biological origins, lest they bring intellectual disrepute on the church or look to be out of date and not with it. But actually, the scientific situation is just the opposite. There's really no compelling reason to accept this as the account of biological origins is at just the time when even mainstream evolutionary biologists are saying, hey, we need a new theory, we need a new mechanism, because standard neo-Darwinism just isn't getting the job done.
Obviously, you're known for the intelligent design movement. For those listeners that are maybe not familiar with that term, could you tell us briefly what intelligent design theory entails and how that differs from theistic evolution?
Yeah, sure. intelligent design is the idea that there are certain features of biological systems or of the universe itself that are best explained by reference to the action of a designing intelligence rather than an undirected, unguided process such as mutation and natural selection in biology. The kind of features that we are seeing in living systems or in the universe that are that we think are indicative of design are things like the miniature machines, the nanomachinery that's being discovered inside cells, the digital code that's necessary to build all forms of life and that nanomachinery, and the complex information processing systems that are characteristic of living cells and animal development. Organisms are turning out to be much more complex than anyone envisioned in the 19th century when Darwinism was first formulated. And the complexity is of an informational and integrative type that is characteristic of all design systems of which we know. So then you also have evidence such as the fine-tuning of laws and constants and initial conditions of the universe in physics that sometimes is known as the anthropic fine-tuning or the anthropic principle. Mm. And there are evidences of the action of a designing agent in biology, physics, and other disciplines that we think are detectable. And that is one of the key distinctions between the proponents of intelligent design and theistic evolutionists. Theistic evolutionists want to say that God has acted in an undetectable way only through secondary causes, and so they wanted to attribute the creative power of God with the evolutionary process somehow, and then say that God is somehow behind that. We've been challenging them to clarify whether they think that that evolution is a directed or an undirected process, and pretty much the answers that have come back are either we don't know or it's undirected and unguided. God merely is upholding the laws of nature, and then the mutation selection process does all the important creative work without God really even knowing where that's going to end up. One theistic evolutionist, Ken Miller, has said that the process could just as well have produced a big-brained dinosaur as a big-brained bipedal human being. Since God isn't directing the process, it's not really clear that he also knows where it's going to end up. So in any case, we think that the activity of the designing agent, and for those of us who are Christian proponents of intelligent design, that would be God, is detectable in, as the Book of Romans says, in the things that are made in the natural world.
This is one of the things that I really appreciated about this book that has just come out called Theistic Evolution. a scientific, philosophical, and theological critique, is really in this book, you're challenging those that would want to hold to theistic evolution to really clarify what it is exactly that they believe. Because often, you know, and I have a number of friends that hold to theistic evolution. And this is exactly what I find that there is a lot of mystery over with what exactly is it that they hold to. And in your book, chapter 19, I felt like this is one of the crux issues, I believe. And that is, should theistic evolution depend on methodological naturalism? And that if that's the case, how exactly does that work? Because what it seems to be is that then evolution is completely out of God's hands. So like was mentioned, who knows what's going to come up? Maybe humans could have been dinosaurs with big brains. Or you have just a very deterministic universe, and then perhaps that's how God's being undetectable within this framework. And why is it that God needs to be undetectable? That seems to be a very interesting commitment that we see in our culture. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, God needs to be undetectable for most theistic evolutionists because they have committed themselves to methodological naturalism. And methodological naturalism is nothing other than the idea that science should limit itself to explaining all phenomena by reference to purely natural or materialistic processes, sometimes it's called methodological atheism, that the scientists should study the universe as if it were the case that God did not exist. So the science of the theistic evolutionist becomes indistinguishable from the science of the atheistic evolutionist or from any evolutionary biologist in the secular world. It might be helpful to go back to even an earlier part of the book, which was the introduction, because I think you've hit on something very important, that the term theistic evolution, or evolutionary creation as it's now sometimes called, is really slippery because the term evolution itself can mean many different things. So one of the things we do at the very beginning of the book, it's in my introduction to the book itself, is define the term evolution and show that it has multiple different meanings, and then show that by theistic evolution, a theistic evolutionist could be many different things, some of which are innocuous, like evolution means change over time, then clearly God can cause change over time. God could even cause continuous change over time that would make something like universal common descent true. So you could be a theistic evolutionist who believe that all organisms were related by common ancestry. I'm skeptical of universal common descent for scientific reasons, but that's at least a coherent meaning of the term, and one which doesn't necessarily render theism kind of redundant in that formulation. But the main meaning of evolution that's part of the modern synthesis and all extended synthesis theories, as they're called in evolutionary theory, is the idea that there is a materialistic mechanism, usually emphasizing mutation and natural selection, that is responsible for all the new forms of life that we see in the history of life, as well as the appearance of design that those forms manifest. And if that's what theistic evolutionists mean by evolution, I think that becomes problematic, because either they have God directing an undirected mechanism or an undirected process, which is an oxymoron, a logical problem, or God is not directing that process, which I think is a theological problem. It isn't the same as deism exactly, because they still hold that God is upholding the laws of nature on a moment-by-moment basis. But the crucial mechanisms of evolution is in no way guided or directed. It's as if God had designed a roulette wheel, and then somebody else spins it, and the outcome is undetermined and unknown by God. So he's not in charge of the outcome of the roulette wheel, only its original construction. And that, I think, entails a form of diminished divine sovereignty in the process of creation, which is pretty hard to reconcile with any reasonable reading of the Judeo-Christian scriptures. So I think either the theistic evolutionists have a logical problem, a theological problem, or the third option is that they often will not say whether they think the process is guided or unguided. And at that point, their theory has no empirical content. It's just a kind of general agnosticism. It's not clear at all what role God plays in this overall schema. And it also ends up being quite convoluted for reasons I could explain in a shorter answer. So,
within your book, you have your section on science, but you also have sections on philosophy as well as theology. But within your philosophy section, what are the issues that come up there?
Well, J.T. Moreland has an excellent essay there talking about how theistic evolution undermines confidence in the knowledge of God, and he's a staunch proponent of the idea that that we can have, if as philosophers do, if we define knowledge as justified true belief, he thinks it's possible to have justified true belief in God, and you can have justified true belief also in the Judeo-Christian scriptures, that there's good reasons to believe it. If every time the theistic evolutionists make or if every time science makes a new claim or comes up with a new theory, including ones that challenge or appear to challenge the Bible, and then the Christian world quickly reformulates their understanding of Scripture, Moreland argues that it becomes very hard to believe that Scripture is giving us anything like the truth, that it's essentially the truth of Scripture has to be read through an evolutionary hermeneutic. And one of the things that I said in our session back in Rhode Island to the assembled theologians and biblical scholars there was that, in a way, the purpose of the book was to relieve them of the sense of intellectual obligation that they have to read Scripture through an evolutionary hermeneutic. The theory itself is not scientifically well-grounded enough to justify that, especially with respect to its core claims about the creative power of these evolutionary mechanisms. There's great grounds for skepticism. So the last thing theologians should be doing right now is reinterpreting core Christian doctrines in light of evolutionary theory, when evolutionary theory itself is being not only reinterpreted, but reassessed and reevaluated and critically evaluated.
We're noticing, as you mentioned earlier, that there is pressure on theologians to adopt a theistic evolutionary approach, and we see that with guys like Timothy Keller have gone that route, and you can see how that begins to become persuasive perhaps for others. But I've noticed in the sciences, you know, particularly, evolution's the only game in town. And so you get this sense then that if somebody wants to be a Christian and they want to be in the sciences, that they almost feel like they have to be a theistic evolutionist. And I'm wondering, you know, your opinion on that, because what you see is that there is pretty much no room for anything other than neo-Darwinism. And I wonder, not only for the Christian do they feel the pressure to adopt that, but what about those that are critical of neo-Darwinism? You know, and perhaps they're not Christian, or they're not even open to theistic evolution. Do they have the same sort of pressure being put on them as well?
Oh, I think there's immense sort of social pressure. My Orthodox Jewish colleague, David Klinghoffer, says that what's clearly driving the support for theistic evolution in the Christian world, as well as in the Jewish world, is a sense of social anxiety. You know, that if there's a kind of pervasive ethos that says, hey, all reasonable people agree, you don't want to be the one person who says, well, I don't agree, and therefore get labeled as unreasonable. So one of the things we do in the book is really go into some depth about the different aspects of the case for neo-Darwinism and the subsequent new models that are being proposed. And we had the book was endorsed, or there was a foreword written for the book by a non-Christian philosopher of science, Steve Fuller from University of Warwick in the UK. And Fuller's quite a good historian of science, and he's actually sympathetic to ID, even though he's not an Orthodox Christian. And he said that the book was written in what he called the spirit of the Reformation, which was the, hey, read it for yourself, check it out for yourself kind of spirit. And he said that the book provides the information that pastors, theologians, educated lay people can the information that they need to make an informed decision about the status of evolutionary theory and therefore whether or not they want to synthesize it in some way with their theistic belief. So the subject is not as hard as people think. There were five key arguments for universal common descent, two or three key arguments for the creative power of natural selection in the origin of species. They're easily understood, and there are problems with those arguments that are also now easily understood, and we lay them out in the book so people do have the opportunity to sort of weigh the evidence for themselves. And it's an extraordinary international cast of scientists and philosophers, as well as theologians who are involved in the project.
Probably one of a very important question that a lot of people have on their minds is, how does this view impact biblical interpretation?
Well, the theologians take this up in the last third of the book, and it's there's a couple ways. One, if you hold to the idea that there was a completely undirected mechanism that produced all the forms of life that we see, then it's pretty hard to say in what sense God acted as the creator. It's also pretty hard to say, there's no logical basis then for saying that God has any kind of providential foresight about the future. And so it sounds kind of innocuous at first. Well, we just think that natural selection and random mutation is the way that God created. But when you realize the mechanism is undirected, and that's a logical requirement of Darwinian theory, by the way. Darwinism claims that there's no evidence of actual design, only the appearance of design. And since the design is only apparent but not actual, that means whatever mechanism produced it was not directed or guided, because if it had been directed, then it would be actual design. So the undirected nature of the mechanism is a logical requirement of the theory. So when people say they accept this theory and that this is how God created, they're saying that God has somehow used this undirected mechanism. Well, once you accept that, then it means that God isn't actively involved in creation. There's no logical basis for thinking that he in any way knows the future, which means you can't have anything like the doctrine of divine providence. You can't have something like messianic or other forms of prophecy. All those things go away. Then, in addition, most theistic evolutionists deny that there was an original human pair from which the rest of the human race arose. So then the idea of both the creation and the fall of man become untenable. And at that point, the doctrine of the atonement, I think, becomes incomprehensible. If there was no creation, no fall, then there's no need for redemption either. And so what sounds at first like a very innocuous concession to evolutionary biology ends up gradually eating its way through all the core Christian doctrines, and at the end you're really left with very little.
You know, we want to encourage our listeners to read your book and to continue to look into these issues. I mean, there's so much more that we could talk about. But question I wanted to just ask you and for you to just share with our listeners is, you know, what originally got you interested in this topic? How did you find yourself knee deep in writing and thinking on these issues?
Well, the two parts of that, maybe these issues would include my main and core issue in the theory of intelligent design, which germinated now quite a long time ago in the mid-80s. I was working as a scientist, as a geophysicist, and a conference came to our city, a conference about the origin of the universe, the origin of life, and the mind-body question, the big questions at the intersection between science and philosophy, science and faith. And there were leading atheists and theists on each of the panels, and it was a spirited and exciting discussion. And I got really fascinated with the origin of life question, because the panelists on both sides of the debate made clear that the question was unsolved, and that the key unsolved issue was the origin of the digital code, the information in the DNA molecule that was necessary for life for any life to function, and therefore it was a crucial requirement of the origin of the first life to explain the origin of the information that made life possible. I was working in a field, digital signal processing, that was an early form of information technology, and I got seized and fascinated with the idea that life depended on information, and that the and was became intrigued with the mystery of the origin of that information. I eventually went to the next year off to Cambridge to do a PhD in the philosophy of science. I did my work on origin of life biology, and then almost two decades later, finally finished a book of my own making the case for intelligent design based on the information-bearing properties of DNA. Bill Gates says that DNA is like a software program, but much more complex than any we've ever created. We know that software comes from programmers. In fact, we know that information, whenever we find it, always comes from an intelligent source. So I argued in my book, Signature in the Cell, that the information necessary to produce the first life seemed to suggest the need for a master programmer for life, some kind of designing agent needed to be involved. And I extended that argument in my next book, Darwin's Doubt. I got interested in the theistic evolution debate, mainly because the theistic evolutionists were routinely critiquing the theory of intelligent design and the arguments that I and my colleagues were making, and whereas we never really set out to have our argument with other people in the religious world, they kept publishing books and articles and blogs and things critiquing us, and we thought, well, we need to respond, and one thing led to another, and we realized we had quite a corpus of material by way of response, and we ended up publishing it in the book that you've been kind enough to interview me about.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we're almost out of time, so as we wrap up, Dr. Meyer, if our listeners want to find out more about your work, where can they go?
Well, I've got a really nice website that compiles a lot of what I've done, as well as video debates, lectures, animations. We even have some rap artists who like intelligent design. We have a playlist. So it's called, the website is darwinsdoubt.com. And there's, I think, there's a great wealth of information there. And then I think you can get information about the Theistic Evolution book just on Amazon, or any of the online booksellers are carrying it now, and it's selling quite well for such a behemoth of a volume.
Mm-hmm. I guess we'll wrap up here. Thank you, Dr. Meyer, for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me on. It's been a great conversation.
We've been interviewing Dr. Steve Meyer, the director of Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. And the book that we've been discussing is Theistic Evolution, A Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Critique. Make sure you go out there and get it. Thank you for joining us, listeners. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll see you next week with more stuff to think about.
If you enjoy and appreciate the AC podcast, show us some love on iTunes. Please consider leaving a review. It helps us keep doing what we're doing.